Rob Wolf, Andy Dees, back for episode 12, Paleolithic Solution. How are you today?
Oh, dude, just feeling like, what's the line out of Fletch? I feel like $100.
Fletch reference, man. I haven't heard that in a while.
Fletch is 6'3", 6'7", with the after. Yeah, still recovering from the Lou Mars gig. 5 days of no sleep seriously kicked my ass. So this is going to guaranteed be the worst podcast that we've ever done. I'm asleep at the wheel, but I'll do my best.
Well, you don't have any echo today, but we'll see how it goes as we go along.
I have a cheap little headset on, so hopefully we're getting better. If this thing works, then I'll actually pony up some cash and get a decent headset and see if that helps things. So.
And in all seriousness, I want to thank Miles for explaining the difference between reverb and echo. I had no idea what the difference was, but Rob and I are committed to making this not sound like crap. So we're in the process. You know, we're slow, we're hard-headed, we're very stubborn, but we're going to get it fixed.
Well, since everything we're saying is pseudoscientific and crap, then we should at least make the audio quality good. I mean, if it's crappy sound and crappy content, then, you know, it can't be 100% crap. We've got to have some veneer of something good in there, so.
Well, if it's not Scottish, it's crap, Rob. That's what
that's
I was.
True. That's true.
All right, so I think first on the list, we're gonna let you attempt to describe the Lou Mars event. I know you attempted to via the blog, and you know, give it a shot.
Oh, you know, I just kind of wanted. I did a pretty thorough write up on it, even though I'm again out of my head. But it was a heck of an experience. I guess if anything, I just kind of wanted to retouch on the fact that the way that Lou went out after this thing was amazing. I mean, totally amazing. Both Andy and I wanted to kill him at various times. And Andy and I are, in fact, the only two people on the whole staff who threatened Lou's life verbally at various points in the whole thing, which I was happy when Andy did that, too, because I wasn't the only person who completely lost their melon and was like, Lou, I'm going to kill you. But it was amazing. You know, this dude went out playing these drums, you know, just a really, really aggressive set list. Very fast songs, classic rock and roll, more modern rock and roll, just really good soundtrack, really good music, you know, stuff that by and large, like I liked almost everything in there a lot. And then he played the hell out of it, like spinning the drumsticks, just absolutely trying to crush the drumsticks through the drum heads. It was never quieter than like 100 decibels in the gym. And he did it day after day after day, and it was amazing to watch. People would roll into the gym, and it was day two, day three, and they would ask, how long has he been playing, and how long is he supposed to play, and is he supposed to be playing that hard? You know, it's some really common statements and questions. We had a number of drummers come by and watch him, and it wasn't just that he was playing hard, but because Lou was a show drummer. And I don't know anything about music, but you know, you can play a basic set, then you can play a basic set aggressively, and then you can play a basic set kind of show drumming, where like instead of hitting a cymbal once, you hit it three times for a particular beat and stuff like that. And so he was double and triple tapping the cymbals and overplaying the snare drum and all that, and it was just incredible. And he did it until he literally collapsed. And we got him within 12 hours of beating the current record. And I, you know, obviously you never know for sure, but I think it's a pretty safe bet that had he played a conservative set, the dude could have probably played 150 hours, you know, but it would have been nowhere near as spectacular as what it was. I mean, it seriously captured the hearts and minds of the people that were coming into the gym, the people that watched on Ustream. We had little kids coming into the gym with their own toy drum sets, like playing along with them, and then they would go home and watch the Ustream deal and actually fall asleep playing the drums, and the parents would have to haul them away, and then they would get up and come back and play it again. It was pretty incredible. It was amazing to be a part of, and luckily there were no fatalities, either by accident or by Andy and I bludgeoning anyone. So what are your thoughts on the whole thing? You busted out some amazing dance moves on it, and you are fairly famous, at least in Australia and New Zealand at this point, for your dance moves.
Well, you know, I don't think words can describe what I witnessed. I mean, I think you did a pretty good job, both in the blog post and just there. I mean, I think, you know, I was just stunned at, you know, how hard Lou played. At various points, how he could rally energy to bring kids up on stage and give them drumsticks. I'm like, Lou, you have been drumming for 90 hours. Like, how do you even have the, you know, wherewithal to know their little kids and to come up there, or, you know, and make their day? I mean, it was stunning. There are certain songs in that set list that I will never listen to again. My Sharona comes to mind. Also, yes. Probably Love Shack.
I don't know. I'm always a big fan of Love Shack, but I could do without My Sharona for a long time. And any MC Hammer, I've always been a little suspect of. But other than that, there was some good stuff. Joey, Creep, just a ton of really good stuff. I think we're going to post that set list at some point so that people can see exactly what was the 6-hour loop that was being played.
And there are some songs like Pearl Jam Alive that definitely have taken on a new meaning, mm-hmm. you know, after watching Lou play that. I mean, you know, it was an unbelievable experience, an honor to be a part of it. I'm glad I was there to witness it. I don't know that I could survive it again.
Absolutely not. We were being interviewed. We had a ton of media over this, and one of the newspaper reporters, I spent almost an hour on the phone with her, and then at the end, I had her on speakerphone. Both Nikki and I were chiming in. And she said, so are you, you know, when do you think, or do you think you would be interested in training Lou again and going for a second time? And Nikki and I started laughing like we were insane people, because we were just like, there is no way on earth we would ever do that again, you know? And I think even for the sanctity of the music, you know, what Lou did, the only way that Lou could better what he did in this event is to just play lighter. And I think that that would really kind of undermine what he established. I mentioned this in my blog post, but it's really going to be interesting to me to see if anybody ever tackles this particular Guinness Book record again. Because on the one hand, you could tackle it and simply try to beat Russ Prager's conservatively played set, which, you know, is legit. That's all good and everything. But I really think the gold standard now is going to be what Lou did. Like, is somebody going to put an aggressive set list out there and then play it in this, like, kamikaze, you know, no regard for their physical well-being, just completely pouring their heart and soul into the music and trying to give it everything that they could? And so it's a real interesting dilemma, I think, for that particular record, because, you know, Lou fell a little bit short of beating the 120 hours, but the 108.5 is second best in the world, and it would have been best in the world as of, you know, prior to March of 2009. So, I don't know, it's very, very interesting. It was definitely a hell of an experience. I'm very, very honored to have been a part of it, although incredibly sleepy now, so...
Yeah, we may reassess in a month. We'll see if our brains are working.
Yeah, we may be pissed, and we may end up beating the tar out of Lou at that point. But at this point right now, there's nothing but the love. So
no, Lou Marr is a beast.
A beast. He's an amazing dude. He's been a client and a friend of ours for a long time. It was just amazing to spend that much time with him and be that focused on the project.
Yeah. Well.
Cool.
Yeah, I don't think I can say any more about that. It was just an amazing event, and, you know, an honor to be a part of it, and, you know, nothing but love for Lou, you know?
Yeah, and thanks to everybody who followed online, sent emails. We had something like 47,000 people checked out the Ustream for between the beginning and the end and all that, so it was amazing. We had upwards of 600 people watching at any given time. Pretty cool. Really, really cool.
Yeah, and also thank you to all the people that volunteered to help much longer than they probably originally planned to. I think there were a number of folks that were just going to help out for a few hours that turned in a significant amount of time, you know, just try to keep Lou going, just because everyone was so dedicated to keeping him going.
Yeah, it was just full-time staffing to keep the wheels on the wagon. And there were dozens and dozens of times where we nearly, you know, had the event shut down because of, like, equipment issues, not being able to wake Lou up after a nap. I mean, it's just a zillion different things. Running out of music when Lou was skipping through his set list. there were a ton of these little, you know, almost catastrophes that took all of our best effort to avoid, and it was an incredibly intense experience for sure. But we'll quit going on and on about that. But there were a lot of people that followed it and just wanted to fill folks in on it.
Yeah. All right, so on to less interesting things.
Yes.
But a frequent topic that I think we've touched on a little bit, and you talked about on your blog, so we're going to revisit it a little bit for folks, and we're gonna hit pre-workout nutrition and just get your thoughts on it. I know every few days I seem like we get a comment on the blog. We got a number of emails in the question queue, kind of, hey, how do you guys handle pre-workout nutrition? I see what you're recommending post-WOD and other times of the day. So I thought we'd kind of just talk about it a little bit and hopefully have the final word on this topic, although there is no final word on anything, I'm afraid.
No, it doesn't look like it. Like I typed at the Lumars thing, this has all happened before, it will all happen again. So straight out of Battlestar Galactica. But, you know, the thing, I feel like we have helped people get a pretty good handle on post-workout nutrition and the kind of different variables involved with that. You know, if you're oriented on fat loss, if you're oriented on performance, if that performance is strength-oriented or whether it's kind of metabolic conditioning or more endurance-oriented, I feel like folks are getting a little grasp on that. And then so this pre-workout nutrition has been popping up a lot. And I think the reason why it's a little more slippery to get a handle on is I've just found the pre-workout nutrition to be wildly variable compared to post-workout nutrition. Pre-WOD nutrition depends a lot on what type of activity you're going to do. If you are going in to do some strength work, then I find that people tend to benefit from maybe a little bit of like protein and maybe a little bit of coffee, like getting that dopamine and getting the neurotransmitters really cooking is a great way to do that. And it's a very narrow therapeutic window on the caffeine. Like a little goes a long way, you know, unfortunately, you know, since I'm cracking the crack addict on the coffee. But you know, a pre-WOD meal for strength oriented work, I really like some of that protein plus a little caffeine. If you want to have a little bit of carbs in there, fine. If you want a little fat in there, fine, but I just don't find it being all that beneficial. And Tom Fahey of California State University Chico has done a bunch of research on this. Dan John has referenced him. He and Dan John are really good friends. And for strength work, it seems like that pre-WOD, like branched chain amino acids, you know, protein source seems to do people very, very well for strength-oriented work. Then we start looking at something like mixed modal, you know, CrossFit-style metabolic conditioning. And then it just becomes a really subjective, you know, situation. For myself, I just can't work out with anything in my stomach. Or, like, it's got to be very, very minimal. For me to do my best on kind of CrossFit-type stuff, I really need to be almost getting hungry. You know, there's kind of a wacky, narrow window for me to do my best, because if I get too hungry, then I'm going to kind of not feel that great in the WOD. But then if I have any amount of food in my stomach, then I'm just kind of burpy and lethargic, and I'm just kind of a puss, and I don't want to barf. So I end up going easier. And so I have this kind of in-between window where my stomach's empty, but my energy is good, and then I can really hammer it. I know other people who can do great on a WOD after having eaten a meal, you know, protein, carb, protein, fat, whatever, they do fine. And so my experience with all that stuff is that you really need to figure out, okay, what type of exercises that I'm doing. If it's strength work, I think it'll typically benefit from some protein pre-workout, although Matt Malone's been doing a lot of experimentation and reading on intermittent fasting before training, and that's kind of a whole other thing. I think Martin Beckham has some great stuff talking about that also, but again, you want to make all the timing to that appropriate. Maybe we can do a podcast kind of talking about that. I don't want to get into that too much right now. But, you know, we've got the strength orientation, then we've got kind of the CrossFit WOD kind of orientation, in which you're going to have to simply experiment and see what you feel best on. And I just can't give you any more solid a thing than that. I think when you do reading on high-intensity interval training, usually the recommendation is to eat some sort of a, you know, meal 2 to 3 hours before so that gastric emptying isn't an issue. I think that's a pretty solid recommendation there. And then obviously we're just kind of focusing on what the composition of that is. And you can play with doing it low carb. You can play with doing it protein and carb. Again, it depends on what your goals are and what you're up to. And you really just need to get in and experiment that stuff. And then long endurance efforts, when I'm thinking about that, anything over 2 hours, then we need to start thinking about event-specific fueling. But beyond that, I think, you know, kind of a standard meal, protein, fat, is probably good to go for a standard endurance event that's going to be kind of sub-lactate. And then as you get longer and longer in the event, then you'll start doing mixed composition meals, protein, carb, a little bit of fat, to be able to power you through. And we really saw that with Lou, actually, this weekend. When we could get, like, some protein and carbs in him, he just plowed through stuff. It was like we had the ignition switch firing. We just needed the fuel to be able to burn it. And as long as we kept feeding him, he kept going. And talking to Kelly Starrett, a couple other people who have some experience in real long duration activity, then we see some good benefit, or, you know, have to fuel appropriately during the long event deal. So that's getting off topic, but hopefully it kind of bookends it all together. Andy's like, dude, shut up. So so those are my thoughts on the pre-WOD meal. What do you... You got anything to add to that, Andy?
I think, to be clear, though, I think for most folks, we're talking about real food.
Right.
I think there's a lot of stuff out there about these drinking shakes before, during the workout, not really sold that there's much benefit to it. And honestly, my humble opinion for most folks, I think we're really spun up about pre-WOD nutrition, and I'm just not sold that it makes that big a difference in the long run for most folks.
Yeah, I'm not either. And it becomes that thing again where if you are really legitimately pushing the boundaries of human performance and recovery and circa event performance, you know, the event-specific performance is so important that we need to be perfectly dialed into that, and that's, I guess, kind of one thing. But we've produced some really remarkable performance in people without much focus in that area, and that's not to say that we possibly couldn't get more juice out of that, but Glenn Cordoza, a mixed martial arts fighter, is a great example of that. Usually when he was going in for a session, he would rather be a little bit, you know, definitely he would do a breakfast, and then 2 hours later he'd go in and do a session, maybe mid-session, a 2 to 3 hour session. He'd have a little piece of fruit or something like that, and then he would do a protein and carbohydrate meal post-workout, and he did amazing on that. And a lot of it is being able to have enough kind of empty stomach to be able to train hard, you know, it depending on what you're up to. I totally agree, though, that the pre-WOD feeding and mealing and all that stuff, I just think it's super hyped by the supplement scene. And there's some kind of compelling stuff to get in and tinker with it, but for 90-95% of people, I just think it's kind of silly. It's just shooting shooting a cannon out of a canoe. I mean, it's just not. You need to focus on some other stuff, food quality, getting some sleep. All these other things are going to give you way better return than focusing overly on pre-WOD nutrition.
Yeah, it reminds me of something Ito once said, where just because you can see the ladder of the rung and you know it's up there and you know that, you know, pre-WOD nutrition is important, doesn't mean that that's the ladder of the rung and that you're on.
Right.
And it may not be time to spend any amount of effort thinking about it. And I feel like for a lot of folks, you know, to your point, sleep, food quality, a bunch of other stuff is going to pay them, you know, much higher ROI, you know, than worrying about pre-WOD nutrition.
Yeah, and it just people, this is a lot of the short attention span theater deal, you know, like you need to pick a program that you like, you need to stick with it for long term, you need to think about some of the periodization of what it is that you're up to, you need some damn goals, you know, and so that this is all this stuff that kind of weaves it all together, and then that will, to some degree, it's almost like goal panning or something. Like, you have all that stuff delineated, and you take care of all these big things. Sleeping, general food quality, a qualitative-oriented training approach, not just slapdicking stuff together. And then suddenly when you have all that stuff in line, then that these little nuances of like pre or post workout food and all that kind of the importance becomes obvious. And then it's very, very easy to experiment with it and to find out whether or not it works optimally for you, and then to be able to refine it in.
Yeah, that was very Dan John of you, Rob.
I've been drinking scotch all day.
No, but I think Dan in his book, you know, Never Let Go, and some of his videos talks about having, you know, his standard routines that he goes back to and then can experiment with other variables to kind of have an idea of how, you know, the additional things he's manipulating, you know, are having an effect on him.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of intelligence there. On a totally unrelated but related topic, did you ever try that Ultimate Orange drink, I think it was called?
I did not, but it had some potential gluten contamination in it. Like it said made in a facility that handles wheat, and so I have not played with that one, yeah.
Yeah.
Just I know a number of people in the gym, like Lonnie and some other people, really like it. I think NutriShop here in town... that's kind of like a private label thing that they have, so,
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I just remember back in the day, there was rumors that the initial batches were spiked with some...
Oh, really? Some goodies? there's some interesting stories on that, like Bill Phillips.
Yes.
Where a little bit of Dianabol went out in the first couple of rounds, and people got amazing results, and then the hype caught on after that, but all of the product is gone, so there's nothing for the FDA to track down as... Interesting stuff.
Yes, good reading. Okay, sorry to encourage you to go off topic.
That's, oh man,
my fault.
Do it today. I'm halfway there anyway.
All right. So the next topic we wanted to cover was the fish oil calculations. We have about, I think, 10 to 15 questions in the question queue about this. Number of questions on the blog. So we'll give you another chance to try to simply explain, you know, what current thinking is on how much fish oil folks are consuming, and we can kind of spin off of that.
Right. Okay. So I am never going to put anything with a numerical calculation up for anybody ever again. it ends up creating a nightmare of a question and answer for Andy and I. But basically where we're at with this is that folks who, particularly when they're new to, you know, like CrossFit or rolling into your gym, or like they're navigating to the blog and they're like, well, okay, I'm going to start taking some fish oil. How much should I take? What we're trying to do is to reverse an omega-3, omega-6 imbalance that is just inherent in a grain-fed diet. And this is true whether we're talking about you eating grains or the critters that we are eating grains. And so they end up becoming very heavy in omega-6. We need to try to balance that omega-3, omega-6 situation out, because it's very pro-inflammatory and causes a lot of problems. So this is based largely off of work from Poliquin, but it's very, very similar in numerical value for what you see out of the Omega RX zone from Barry Sears. And it's that you would recommend somewhere between 0.5 and 1 gram of EPA and DHA per 10 pounds of body weight per day. And the half a gram is for people who are, you know, generally healthy, but they, you know, they've just been eating kind of a standard diet. The 1.0 level is for people who are very overweight or are sick. And I would argue that if you're very overweight, then the likelihood that you've got some significant illness brewing is probably pretty high. And so we and it's a pretty aggressive, you know, recommendation. But this is to just basically get people back to a level of where they should be. And then we find that people probably hit a maintenance of somewhere around like a quarter of a gram of EPA DHA per 10 pounds of body weight. That seems to be a good maintenance level for most folks, and it usually takes them 2 to 4 months, 5 months to get to that point. And it's just kind of something that you have to play. You're keeping an eye on inflammation and recovery, and when you start recovering really well from activity and the soreness is kind of decreasing, then you start titrating that fish oil down, and you find kind of a carrying point with it. There's some blood work that you can do to track that, but the EPA arachidonic acid blood test is fairly expensive. So, you know, this we just try to make this thing more of a qualitative sort of deal. So for this example, if we had, say, a 200-pound male, and we let's put him at the lower end of that recommendation, 200-pound guy, half a gram per 10 pounds of body weight, We've got, you know, basically divided his body weight by 10, so we've got 20, and then we put that half a gram into it, so we're talking about, you know, like 10 grams total, approximately. And that's where he would probably find a pretty good maintenance dose. And people kind of freak out about that level when it's capsules, because a given capsule may only have, say, like 300 or 400 milligrams, and so it ends up taking several capsules to equal a gram of fish oil, and so people may be taking 20 or 30 capsules of fish oil, depending on what brand they have. If we have liquid fish oil, then it's only like a tablespoon or two, so it seems much less. But people really get wigged out and freaked out about that, but it's really not that much, and really all we're trying to do is replace something that's missing out of the diet.
Yeah, and I think one other consideration is when adding any supplement, zinc, etc., my recommendation is always a ramp-up period,
mm-hmm.
kind of like with exercise. You know, we'll get some folks that will, you know, go from zero fish oil to 20 grams the next day, and sometimes that has some unusual side effects.
Sure, sure. Yeah, you need to stay near a commode for the first couple of days transitioning into that. So, yeah.
So I think a safer bet is to kind of slowly ramp it up like you would any smart exercise program.
Totally, totally. So hopefully that helps people wrap that around their wheelhouse, get that all wrapped up, and understand why we would recommend that. And this is consistent with other people that are, you know, out in the kind of fitness and strength and conditioning community. This is fairly similar recommendations of other well-known folks. People ask for literature to support these levels. There's literally like 4,000 to 6,000 research papers a week that are being generated on fish oil right now. I mean, it's impossible to even come close to staying on top of it all. And there's a ton of stuff out there. I would just encourage folks to do a little bit of investigating on their own. And, you know, simple Google search can track down a lot of information for you.
Yeah, I think the only challenging thing with some of the literature that I haven't seen and maybe you've seen is that there's not a ton of literature out there on dosages this high.
Right. There's only a little bit this high, yeah.
Yeah, now, to your point, this is, I think, pretty consistent with Poliquin. It's consistent with Berardi's recommendation, a number of other folks. There just isn't a lot of documented scientific data to support it.
Right.
But we haven't lost anybody yet.
None that we haven't been able to dispose of the body. So, yeah, we're fine on that.
No. In all seriousness, just kidding. All right, so hopefully that helps. Let us know if we have further muddied the waters, but you know, I think that makes things a little clearer, and please ramp up your dosage slowly.
Yes.
Okay. Excuse me. So moving on, we have another interesting question from Miss Spinach from the blog. So two simple questions about digestive enzymes. Number one, why might a person have stomach acid deficiency worse in the morning at breakfast than later in the day? Doesn't Poliquin say something about people who have trouble eating a high-protein meal for breakfast? Is time of day somehow a factor, or the hours of fasting created by sleep?
That one's pretty interesting. I would definitely say if the individual had some sort of low cortisol in the AM. So normally our cortisol levels should be ramping up in the AM, and that's part of what wakes us up. It releases energy, it makes us alert, ready to tackle the day. And somebody who has an altered adrenal function could, you know, certainly I think that this would be made worse. And we see this a lot with people that they just simply don't want to eat in the morning. And this is another thing that got from Poliquin, which is you get these clients, these folks that just really do not want to eat in the morning, particularly protein. You throw some of something like the Now Foods super enzymes or just a basic betaine hydrochloride in with that meal, and then they actually get some appetite and they want to eat. But I would suspect that it is related more to a low cortisol issue in the morning, and then conversely, like a potentially high cortisol in the evening, paradoxical or the reverse cortisol situation.
Yep, good. All right, part two of the question. So she's tinkered with several different types and brands of the enzymes and seems to do best with just the plain
Betaine hydrochloride.
Thank you. I'm so tired. And not the enzyme formulas with multiple different ingredients. And I only need them from like 7 a.m. to noon. Am I completely weird, or is there some rhyme or reason behind this?
It kind of makes sense. I mean, if she's producing adequate levels of particularly pancreatic enzymes, so we release some pepsin and pepsinogen in the stomach, and then that stuff which digests proteins. We have some salivary amylase, which it happens in the mouth, and that breaks down carbohydrates a little bit. But the lion's share of digestion happens in the pancreas. We end up with proteases, things that break down carbohydrates, things that break down and emulsify lipids or fats. But you can have some people, and it's interesting, this is another one of these gluten intolerance things that I've been reading about. If we have an irritated gut lining, then the cholecystokinin that would normally fire or, you know, regulates turning on and turning off of pancreatic enzyme secretion kind of gets goofed up. And so we may not release the pancreatic enzymes at the correct times. And the betaine hydrochloride, just that acidic environment, is actually kind of the main signal that fires the release of the pancreatic enzymes. And so if the main issue is just hypochloridia, if it's low stomach acid, but we don't have a problem with pancreatic enzyme status, then you likely would benefit more from just a basic betaine hydrochloride, just getting the stomach pH lower, getting that content of acid higher, and then it's going to basically fire all the mechanisms that we need to release pancreatic enzymes. A lot of people, though, have kind of a blowout or a low level of pancreatic enzyme secretion in addition to low stomach acid. So that's largely, I think I kind of fall in that camp, and it's probably from trying to overeat for years and years and years, trying to get big, but never really pulling the thing off all that effectively. I think I'd probably put, you know, I'm almost 38, and I've probably put about 58 years worth of eating on my body. And so I think my pancreatic enzymes are a little on the low side, because I really benefit from kind of a mixed bag deal of the betaine hydrochloride and the protease, you know, lipase, amylase combinations, the protein, carbohydrate, fat digestive enzymes. So this is interesting. It makes sense, though.
Yeah, that is very interesting. And I think I would be in the camp with her where it's much worse in the morning as far as my acid deficiency, and it's much better later in the day.
Mm-hmm.
But I never gave it a lot of thought, actually.
Yeah, that did totally make sense.
Hmm. All right, good question. Cool.
Totally.
All right, so moving on, we got a question from Stu related to fish oil. We're going to come back to that topic. I'm going to read the first part because I want to make a comment, because I've had a lot of caffeine today, and hanging out with Rob has made me obnoxious. So,
okay.
So Stu says, "Stop moving paper, Rob."
Say that again. You broke up there a little bit.
It sounds like you're sanding wood, whatever you just did. Stop.
Oh, okay.
I think you were shifting positions.
I did. Okay. I did. I will not move.
All right. We'll have to teach you how to mute that headset. But anyway, never mind. Okay. So, question from Stu. Okay, I blame Andy for this one because he's always talking in the podcast about his fish oil addiction. First, I'm really enjoying all the great info on your site and in your podcast. I'm only 1 month into doing CrossFit, 5 total workouts because they leave me so sore for the next 5 days that I can't work out, and I'm starting to clean up my diet. So I just want to make a comment that, dude, I don't know how hard your workouts are, but please, for the love of God, scale them to some reasonable amount of effort so that you are not so sore you can't do anything for 5 days.
Yeah, you'll make better progress on that, interestingly.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think we have some folks in our gym that when you start, like, the level of actual CrossFit WOD time, I mean, literally can be 5 to 8 minutes, depending on how deconditioned they are, and that is plenty of enough stimulus in the beginning to see results.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. But so folks want to beat themselves worse, but you want to dig a little hole and then let your body fill that up and super compensate and kind of go back and forth on that. And the tendency to overdo it is pretty potent.
Yeah, and so I'm always with the, let's never make it more complicated than it has to be, and let's never make it harder than it has to be.
Right.
Unless you just want to for some silly reason. Anyway, okay. So, moving on. says, okay, so both you and the nutrition coach at my affiliate, shout out to CrossFit Scottsdale, great people. I used to live in Scottsdale, so there you go. Recommend consuming a ton of fish oil per day to start the body moving away from insulin resistance, so I'd like to start including that in my diet. Tuesday night, I decided to have some dinner, and I downed 10 1-gram pills, and the result was some very bad heartburn, which I'm still experiencing this morning, nearly 36 hours later, although it's much more tolerable now than the first 12 hours. I pretty much never get heartburn, so I'm definitely attributing it to the pills, which was the only thing out of norm about my diet dinner on Tuesday. Is this common when adding fish oil to your diet for somebody who is so, how do you say it, metabolically deranged? Should I start with a smaller amount of pills per day? I know ideally they should be spread out through the entire day. If so, how many total per day as I'm ramping up to the recommended level?
Oh, man. Given the fact that Stu apparently likes to beat the tar out of himself and took 10 of these in one meal, I'm almost guessing that he took 10 in one gulp and the heartburn was actually like a perforated esophagus and he was like bleeding out all night. Crikey. Yeah, I mean, definitely ramping this up easier, spreading these out throughout the day. I've never really heard anybody say that they have heartburn from taking fish oil. So that really is odd to me. So, I mean, I would dial that back and maybe try like 3 per meal and then see how you do with that. I mean, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and a snack, you know, 3, 6, 9, and then one with a snack, and you're pretty covered. I don't know. What do you think on that, Andy?
Yeah, I think start with the smaller dosage. The heartburn thing is pretty unusual. I agree with you. I mean, it could be something where maybe a higher purity one down the road would maybe necessary for Stu, but I think, you know, 3 a meal to start, see how you go, roll with that for a few days before, you know, moving up slowly towards your desired dosage.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, and definitely keep us updated, Stu. I'd be curious to see at the lower dosage if you're still getting that heartburn, because that is really, really unusual.
Yeah, I don't remember anybody mentioning that as a side effect.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I don't think we made up the term metabolically deranged, but I'm glad that you like that, Stu.
It's just something to feel good about, I guess.
Try not to take it personally. I'm just kidding.
We try not to tease the metabolically deranged too often. It's mean to do so.
That's right. We're just a little off today. So, good question. Please keep us updated as to how things go.
Totally.
So, cool. All right, next we got a question from Tyler. He attended one of your final nutrition certs in Toronto, Rob. So, nice.
That was a fun one.
Good. His wife and him are 99% paleo compliant and have a five-month-old son. My question is in regards to starting her on solids. Is small early exposure to grains and dairy helpful, or would you recommend Neolithic elimination?
This is completely my own bias on this, but the GI tracts of infants are even less adept at dealing with the Neolithic foods than ours are. I don't think there's any doubt that the folks that have played around with this, and we've had a number of threads on my blog, and I think the performance menu had a little bit of this stuff. People who just start prepping, you know, like they puree chicken and meat and fish and sweet potatoes and fruit, and basically just stick with those paleo type foods, but puree them into a mush and then feed it to the little buggers, and they do great. They do wonderfully on that. And personal bias, like this is, people can either say I'm super extreme or over the top or whatever, but you know, Tyler asked, so this is what I, you know, if it was me, when we have kids, what I'm going to try to do is keep them off of Neolithic foods as long as I can. And I'm not going to make them neurotic about it or make it a big issue, but just to the degree that we have some control over that, we're just generally not going to have that stuff in the house. If they go over to a friend's house, then that's fine. And, you know, we'll just kind of deal with that as it rolls. But I just can't find any compelling reason to throw that stuff in the mix. It just does not make sense to me at all, given the alternatives that we have.
Yep. It's a good question, though.
Yeah. Very, very common question.
I can always see your children wearing little shirts to school, like, please don't feed me any grains.
Yes.
It will be a rough childhood for them. That is for sure.
They'll have to learn jiu-jitsu and kickboxing early. So, yeah.
Awesome. All right, moving on. Next, we got a question from Steve. He says he understands that green beans are forbidden in the paleo diet, but can't figure out why. He thought legumes were generally avoided because of their contribution to acid in the kidney, but green beans appear to have a strong net base effect. If the problem is, how am I saying this word? Man, I'm tired.
Lectin?
Yes, thank you. Lectin. That confuses me too, because don't egg yolks have lectin in them, which is used as an emulsifier when making mayonnaise?
Ah, okay. So Steve is confusing lecithin. He wrote lecithin in here. Lecithin is a type of kind of fat emulsifying, soapy kind of substance. There's lecithin in soy. There's lecithin in eggs. And it's got a polar and a nonpolar end, and it works exactly like soap. Like soap allows oil and water to mix because it makes a kind of a vacuole or a cell around fat globules, and then that is able to be dissolved or suspended in water. And that's very much what lecithin does, but Steve is confusing lecithin with lectins, which lectins are in fact an issue in legumes, and so those are just two completely different things. And, you know, green beans, I think in the whole legume deal, it's probably pretty darn benign comparatively. I eat green beans all the time. I don't really, you know, think too much of it. They're an easy one, particularly when you're on the road, to track down, and at least I know they're comparatively clean and somewhat nutritious and all that. I think it's more like pinto beans, black beans, and all that jive that you really see some very high lectin content in. So that's a story with that.
I'm going to give you 30 seconds to further elaborate on why the lectins are a problem, since we're already on this topic.
The lectins are gut irritants. So similar to the gluten, there are a ton of different specific gut irritants. We see them in nightshades, and we see them in things like white potatoes, you know, the not scopolamines, but these gut irritating elements that are not lectins. There's just a bunch of different things that interact with the gut wall and can cause problems. And in grains and legumes, it's this class of molecules that we call lectins, which are usually involved with cell surface recognition. They can cause a heck of a problem with our gut lining.
Well done. Under 30 seconds, Rob.
Perfect. Got to be a first.
That's got to be a first. We're making progress here.
Yeah.
One step at a time. But that was a good question. And I think most of the folks that I know, you know, similar to you on the paleo diet, don't really seem to have problems with green beans. I don't see it as being a big issue for most people.
No. And again, good acid base load,
yep.
Low glycemic load, and nice antioxidants in it. Like I wouldn't sweat green beans at all.
And they taste yummy.
And they taste great. You know, if you legitimately had some sort of autoimmune issue, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, something along that line where you just generally did not feel all that great and you had been eating a lot of green beans, sure, it's maybe something to delete, but I just don't see that being a real big issue.
Yep. All right. Good. Next question is from Ryan, and basically what he wants to know is he recently came across a beef protein isolate, gluten-free, from Olympian Labs, and wanted to get your thoughts on this specific product. Good or bad? Any opinions?
I would really need to look at this to see what exactly it is. You know, if it's like bovine serum albumin, then that's another fraction of milk, and as Lauren Cordain loves to point out, milk is just filtered blood, cow blood. So there's a great visual for you to contemplate when you're swigging down a jug of milk or taking in some whey protein. I think all this stuff has appropriate places for the right people, and usually the right people are folks that are lean, don't have any inflammatory issues, and all that sort of stuff. I would really need to check out the beef protein isolate from Olympia Labs. I did not check that out before. Let me see if I can pull that up here really, really quick while we're jibby jabbering. Andy, do you have any thoughts on that? Just for, as a network time killer, while I'm trying to track this down.
No, I'm just laughing at the milk is filtered cow's blood because I actually hadn't heard that.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, yeah, that was a classic Lauren Cordain line out of the very first Paleo Brands talk down in San Diego.
Okay. And then it also reminds you of what's the name of the tribe in Africa where they They stab the cow in the jugular and drink the blood?
Yeah, the pastoralists. It's not the Yache, it's the...
I want to say it starts with an M, but I could totally...
Yeah, the Maasai.
Yes.
The Maasai.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's an interesting deal, too. I mean, they live exclusively on yogurt from cow's milk, and then they will, like, puncture the jugular of the cow, get blood out of it, and then whip that into kind of a yogurt-y sort of thing and eat it. And that is mainly what they eat. But they are much taller, stronger, and healthier than all the agrarian tribes that live around them, so...
Yeah, and if you Google it, you can see some pretty interesting video of that online.
Yeah. So not I'm checking out this beef protein isolate. Comes 26% of content comes from ground beef. It sounds like they've just taken like ground beef and then like dehydrated it and put it into protein powder gig. I don't know. I mean, it sounds horribly disgusting to me, but I'm sure Olympian Labs will love that endorsement. I've never tried it. It just sounds like they're taking like standard beef protein, slicing and dicing it down, you know, like doing some enzymatic digestion on it, and then turning it into a protein powder. But I guess that's not too much more gross than taking filtered cow's blood and making whey protein out of it. So I don't know. You can give it a shot. I don't. Like all liquid foods, it's still going to have some insulinogenic issues. And so if the individual is not lean or if they, you know, they have any type of inflammation, I don't really see it doing them any favors there.
Yeah, I think the other part of Ryan's question, which maybe we can just touch on specifically, is I think a lot of people have brought up the fact that when you did your mass gain, you took the Isoflex chocolate whey protein.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people have taken that to mean that that is an endorsement of that specific brand or type of protein, and I'm not sure that it really was.
No, it was just a clean, guaranteed to be gluten-free form of whey protein. That was it. That was the totality of it.
Yeah, and I think the tough thing, as we found out during the Lou Mars event, to find a gluten-free protein powder can at times be very complicated.
Yeah, because we gave Lou a shake that was donated and very, very nicely donated to us from a local NutriShop, but then we gave it to Lou. Like, I took a swig of it, tasted it, and Andy and I were like, okay, that tastes pretty good. And then about 30 minutes later, 15 minutes later, I had, like, pretty serious side cramp, and then we gave it to Lou, and 30 minutes later he had a side cramp, and he's like, what was in that? And I think Andy read it, and he's like, dude, there was gluten in that. Like, it was like a gluten extract or like a grain extract, and I was just like, oh my god, this is killing me, you know? So, yeah, it's tough. And most of these things, even if they don't have gluten put in it specifically, they're made in facilities that, you know, share equipment that also has gluten in it, and so you can get some cross-contamination that way.
Yep. So, all right, good. Next, we have a question from Matt. He is a client that she's gotten to take Costco fish oil pretty regularly, 2 caps per meal, 3 times a day. She is very out of shape, not really overweight. Did I say very out of shape? Not really overweight, has lots of stress, and if she takes any more than 2 caps of the fish oil, she has very loose stools. Other than taking the fish oil with food, what can I do to help her and others that may experience this problem in the future?
Since they're going to Costco, maybe stock them up on a lot of toilet paper? some people have, interestingly, even though, you know, our diet is generally overladen with omega-6s, some people may not need that much omega-3, and or, like, she may actually need some tinkering of some GLA in there. She may need a longer chain omega-6 to help balance the omega-3s. Even though she's overdone in omega-6s right now, that GLA actually regulates some of the conversion of the like, good eicosanoids that Barry Sears talks about, and it can lead to loose stools. And so that's where a little bit of further tinkering might be necessary for her. This is a pretty rare example. Oh, you know what? The one thing pops into my head, though, now that I'm talking about this. She could also have a mild fish intolerance, like that long-chain saturated fat. And so the other thing to try would be a very highly refined fish oil, like a Nordic Naturals, or I still like Carlson's. We had some guy pop up on the comments saying it was like, Carlson's the Satan, and then I was like, dude, can you substantiate this? And then he disappeared, and so I don't know what the exact deal was with that, but some sort of pharmaceutical-grade fish oil might be the next step to try with her and see if she tolerates that better and doesn't get GI disturbance from it.
Yeah, obviously I don't think we're going to reinforce good behavior if every time she takes three she has loose stools.
Yeah. But this is a pretty rare deal. So those are the two thoughts that I have. And, you know, now that I think about it, it's probably more of like a fish intolerance thing that I would lean towards first. So I would say step her up to a better quality fish oil, which she's probably going to be thrilled about that because she bought her Costco fish oil and then she's going to have to get a different one. The other one's going to be more expensive, but that's just the way it goes. So
buy a small bottle to try.
Yeah, buy a small bottle to try it. And maybe ask the folks at the supplement place too, just say, hey, I've had problems with fish oil. Can I return this if it doesn't work out for me? They're usually pretty good about that. So
yeah, and I was actually thinking this morning, I don't know why, but reminding myself, you know, when you buy supplements in the beginning, buy them in small amounts. I have like 10 jars of ZMA sitting in my closet, which is great, except I only use the Natural Calm generally before bed now. And I'm like, what am I going to do with this?
All that stuff. Yeah, totally.
Like, I'll figure something out. Anyway, all right.
We'll throw a ZMA party. It'll be like a rave, only we'll actually fall asleep instead of get up and dance around. That's right.
All right, next we got a question from Rosemary. She attended Nutrition Cert in Seattle, Woodville, or is that Woodinville? Was that
Woodinville, yeah. Woodinville. Yeah.
All right, shows what I know about the Seattle area. She is 4'10", and in December 2008, weighed 131 pounds, began doing the zone. A couple of months before the cert, she started doing paleo. For the last 10 years, she's fluctuated between 135 and 140 pounds. Her current weight is studied between 98 and 101. She's been getting allergy shots for the last year for a grass allergy and got curious about whether or not I was actually allergic to gluten. I know it's really terrible for you, but I thought I would check as an extra incentive to stay clear of it. I was asked if I wanted to check for any other food allergies, and of course I said yes. Here are her results. No reaction to egg white, milk, chicken, yeast, filbert, pecan, walnut, Brazil, sunflower, or cashews. Then she had a number of reactions. I'm not going to read them all, but beef, lamb, pork, etc., etc. She was not tested for seafood, veggies, fruits, or spices, and frankly, she's kind of scared to find out the results. Originally, she was very spooked about the results, but her doctor tried to reassure her that none of these foods would cause enough of a reaction to kill her. My question is that although eating these foods won't kill me, I'm unsure as to what they're doing to my insides. Are they causing inflammation or something else? Not a fan of chicken, but I love, love beef. Did I mention I love it? Your thoughts are appreciated. This is a girl after my own heart here.
Seriously, yeah. We love her, too, for loving beef. So,
and she loves the new podcast, Rob.
Cool. Well, she must be listener number 7. That is awesome. I mean, the food allergy deal is kind of a wacky thing. Food allergy, food intolerance. You can get if we get any type of a gut irritation, let me back up even before that. Under the best of circumstances, even without gut irritation, there's always the potential of any type of proteinaceous thing that we, protein-containing item, somehow irritating the gut or being in contact with the gut when it is irritated, say like from a virus or bacteria or something like that, and then this could then make its way into the body and we could become sensitized to it. And that can either result in kind of an autoimmune kind of direction with it, or it could be more of an allergy type thing. Allergy being a situation in which histamines are released and we get inflammation in that direction. So add to that the complexity that a number of these foods, like the wheat, the rye, the soy, peanuts, oats, a bunch of these things that she had listed that she's actually allergic to, these are known gut irritants. Like, it's a guarantee that these things are gut irritants. You combine eating these foods with things like beef or chicken or, lamb or whatever, things that normally we wouldn't very likely get gut irritation from, and the fact that we've got this combo of a gut-irritating food with a non-gut-irritating food, it opened the door for the non-irritating food to become a problem. And this is, in my opinion, and there's a lot of data to support this, this is where the potential for food intolerances and food sensitivities start popping up from non-Neolithic foods. And I was just reading last night an account of what's the guy's name? Vilhelmir Stefansson, the guy that lived with Inuit for 25 years. He ended up marrying an Inuit woman and living among them. These folks have a very, very monochromatic diet. Like, they ate a couple of types of fish, and they ate seal and walrus and polar bear. And I mean, it was a very, very limited in the types of foods they ate, but we just don't see any type of, food intolerances in these folks. And so I think that it's important to kind of rotate your foods, but I think it's more important based off of the irritating foods that we inevitably get exposed to more than, a monochromatic diet being specifically a problem. My gut sense on that is that it's probably not that big of a deal, although to the degree that we can get as much variety as we can, I think that's fine. I think for her, just being very, very fastidious about avoiding Neolithic foods or any type of gut-irritating food, maybe add in some, again, now food super enzymes. I think Berardi did a piece on gluten intolerance, which I wanted to address that at some point because I had some disagreements with him on some things. But he did mention a type of enzyme product in that write-up that apparently will help if you get some sort of cross-contamination with gluten. So, you order some scrambled eggs at a breakfast place, and it gets cooked on a grill that had French toast on it, it will help prevent gluten reaction that you're going to have in your own gut. So it's, I think some stuff like that could help too. But those are my thoughts on that. I think that this is more of a manifestation of being exposed to problematic foods over the course of time. And I think if she minimizes that stuff and she goes on kind of a rotation, eat beef for a week and then pork for a week and then fish for a week and lamb for a week, then she doesn't see beef for a month, essentially. And even though she loves beef, I think that might be a nice way to deal with this, at least for a period of time.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if she pulled the gut-irritating stuff out that we're sure of, all the grains, etc., for 9 months, and then retested the allergies. I'd be curious to see what the values came back.
I would be too. That would be pretty interesting.
Yeah. I think that would be an interesting experiment. All right, that was a good question.
Yeah.
We love beef as well. And I think my favorite part of your question, Rosemary, is that I was spooked, but the doctor reassured me that none of these foods would cause enough of a severe reaction to kill me.
It's whew, okay.
Thank goodness.
Back to the buffet then.
All right, next we got a question from Drew. Drew's heard some comments about how our digestive system cannot as efficiently process and absorb food when we eat different macronutrients together, like meat and vegetables. This seems to make some sense to me in a practical sense, simply because it seems a stretch to think that Paleolithic human beings would save up their carbs for when they had some protein and fat to eat with them. I was wondering what your thoughts on this topic were and whether it would have any difference on digestion. Here's a link to the page when I first heard about it, and it's a CrossFit Journal piece from Northern Ireland with Dr. Michael Ray talking about macronutrients.
Drew just needs to come to grips with reality and understand that every meal since the beginning of time has fallen out of trees in 40-30-30 macronutrient ratio. And that's just the reality. And if Drew can't come to terms with this, then I don't know, we're probably going to have some sort of intervention on the guy. So my non-dick response is that I think there's probably something to this. I totally think he's on to something good here. This can obviously complicate eating to some degree. The food combining stuff gets a little bit wacky. But if you notice, what they have historically mentioned is protein and veggies, and then fruit kind of eaten alone, and then veggies with starchy carbs. So veggies kind of can go either way. And Lauren Cordain, he's done a really cool job of taking most of these ways of eating, like macrobiotics or food combining or different things like that, and taking a look at them and trying to see to what degree they work. How does it look when we view it through a Paleolithic kind of lens? And he likes elements of the food combining deal, in that, you probably didn't see a hunk of elk just show up, you know, you didn't end up with elk and sweet potato and 5 days out of the week. You know, you would get a whole bunch of one and a whole bunch of another, and there were usually some kind of nutrient-dense, low-carbohydrate, low vegetable matter things that kind of got thrown into the mix here and there, depending on how far north or south latitude the individuals were. And that's pretty easy to wrap your mind around. And then when you look at the potential digestive issues there, proteins and carbohydrates definitely have different enzymatic needs with regards to their digestion. There's probably something to it. And, you know, when we start looking at the mainstay of, like, a cyclic low-carb approach, it starts looking not too far afield from this, particularly even, you know, Marlo DePasquale, really who I would regard as one of the big pioneers in the cyclic low-carb approach. You know, most of your meals would be protein, fat, and veggies. Occasionally, you would have a protein and carb meal, either like protein and carb meal or meals, and he really made the recommendation to minimize the amount of protein that you took in at those meals because, it, you know, you were trying to switch up the body, change the amount of protein that you were taking, and really just emphasize the carbohydrates. But he also commented that it seemed to help the digestion of that whole scene. So I think there's some good wisdom hidden in all of that, and I think it's certainly worth a try.
since you made that slight at you know, someone who will be renamed nameless or whatever, I feel like I'm in Harry Potter. Poor Dr. Sears here. Question, we had another question that's not on the list, but it just was running around in my head since Drew asked this question. And I think, you know, we have said we believe the Barry Sears 45 grams of protein maximum per meal is nonsensical.
Right.
But we did have a user say, or a listener say, I agree with that, but what is your thoughts about the reasonable upper limits for folks?
Oh, man. You know, that's just a really interesting topic. Steve Shafley has pinged me a paper in the past, and I keep losing it, where they did some experiments where they did the bulk of the protein intake in one meal, like post-workout, and they actually ended up finding much, much better total nitrogen retention, total recovery and everything with that singular meal than they did with multiple meals throughout the day. And so there's, you know, yeah, this old, and the Barry Sears kind of early zone recommendations were right in lockstep with the kind of fitness bodybuilding recommendations, which were like 6 or 8 meals a day, like constantly eating, you needed to fire your metabolism, and, you know, all this stuff. And I think most of us probably played around with that, and it was neurotic and tough to do. And I never really felt like it worked all that well. Like, it just, you know, it didn't seem to do me any good. And then when we start looking at some things like intermittent fasting and this punctuated equilibrium, Art Devaney talks about that a lot. You know, it's not just what we do in a steady state, but also the very dramatic punctuated changes that really seem to cause adaptation and growth and stimulate maintenance, enzyme systems in our body. And this doesn't play out well for like a real static either macronutrient intake or consistent calorie intake. It's punctuated. It's up and down. It's all over the place. And I don't know what the best solution is on that. And I have no idea what the upper limit is. There's some really interesting stuff in doing like 1 or 2 large meals and maybe making those around your post-workout period. Serge Noubre was a very well-known bodybuilder in the 70s. He did one meal a day and he ate like 3 pounds of meat in a sitting. In addition, he ate about 3,500 to 3,800 calories in sitting. And that was the one meal a day that he did. Now, does this work for everybody? No, probably not. But there's some really interesting stuff when we start thinking about intermittent fasting and some of these cellular stress mechanisms that kick on. I know Matt Lalonde has been playing around with like a pound of chicken sausage and 4 duck eggs for breakfast on the weekends. And he basically does one meal on these days, or 1 or 2 meals on these days. He does a big breakfast and then maybe like a dinner later on, and that's it. Because he wants to actually have a life on the weekends and run around and not have to worry about feeding and watering himself. And he does great on this. And the dude just benched 300 pounds the other day at like 175 pounds and was back squatting mid fours, deadlifting right around five. It's just kind of a freak of nature, but it's working real well for him. So I don't know what the upper limit is on the protein intake. I honestly don't know for sure what the perfect timing of all that stuff is. There does seem to be a lot of power for taking advantage of that post-workout period for fueling, and there might be something to having a real big protein feeding in punctuated doses or maybe post-workout. But I don't know. It's real interesting stuff, though.
I also want to point out, Rob, whatever that clicking sound is on your end.
Okay, well, maybe it's because I'm flopping my hands around and shaking my hands because I'm so spun up about this. So
I thought that was an interesting question. And I think the way Matt has handled it is very interesting. When you look at his food log and then you look at, okay, I'm going to do the two big meals on the weekends to give him some flexibility. I think, it's pretty sneaky.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah.
So, all right, cool. Next, we got a question from Rachel. She's been listening to the podcast and really enjoying the useful notes. The last one included the claim that eggs aren't good for those with autoimmune challenges. As I deal with autoimmune thyroid issues, this caught my attention. I've read about how eggs are really great nutritionally, but I haven't seen anything about
lysozyme.
Thank you. I'm so tired. Uh-huh. Lysozyme protein causing gut ear issues and leading to worsened autoimmune symptoms. I looked it up on Wikipedia. Lysozyme appears to be a natural human enzyme. So two questions. Can you point me to where I'd find out about eggs as an autoimmune issue? So let's start there.
This I got from Cordain's work. I would need to do a little bit of digging, but this is stuff that Lauren has dug up on the lysozyme and the effect that it has on the gut lining. And something to remind people, like Wikipedia is amazing, absolutely amazing, but it also is not a peer-reviewed source of information. And so lysozyme is a human enzyme, but it's also a chicken enzyme. It's also a beef enzyme. It's a cat enzyme. I mean, we have a superoxide dismutase, which is a antioxidant enzyme that's common in all eukaryotic organisms. I think, it's like everything from a yeast to a whale. So don't get too caught up on, well, this is a human enzyme or a mouse enzyme or whatever. There's a lot more to it than that. And the Wikipedia thing may not have the total goods on that topic. So we can dig that up, some of the references that Cordain has, and put that in the show notes.
No, all right. I'm going to make a note here, Rob, because I know that's that's my job.
Yeah.
Cordain, that's this guy. Rob is not the details guy.
No. Dude, I'm not anything, really. I have no idea. I think the only reason why I'm doing this is everybody else took a giant step backwards, and I was just kind of left standing there. So,
the last man standing. All right. Question two from Rachel is, you recommended cooking eggs thoroughly, but I thought I remembered the Eads recommending eggs less cooked, as it is somehow more healthy. Is the idea that cooking them breaks down this lysozyme protein?
Yeah, the thorough cooking inactivates the lysozyme protein. The issue that the Eads had was stuff like scrambling eggs could oxidize the cholesterol, and oxidized cholesterol is pretty gnarly on the vascular lumen, the tissues, the sensitive tissues in our vascular beds. So what we're talking about here is probably more along the lines of boiling or cooking over medium and stuff like that. You just frequently we'll get people asking us, hey, are raw eggs a good idea? And it's no, for a variety of reasons. They block biotin absorption because there's a B vitamin inhibitor in there that blocks biotin absorption. And then also there's this issue of the lysozyme potentially causing gut irritation, say nothing of getting a wicked dose of salmonella potentially. So cook those eggs, don't necessarily scorch them, and if you're going to cook scrambled eggs, a nice way to do it is extra virgin olive oil that has loads of antioxidants in it, lots of phenolics, and you just cook it with a lot of olive oil and you cook it on a low temperature and don't scorch stuff. That's the big issue.
So you're ruining my day, Rob, because I only cook them in bacon fat, let's be honest.
Oh, well, that works too. That works too. Just don't scorch them.
No, trust me, I won't. But, raw eggs make for great movies, Rob.
They do. But Rocky lost his first movie, so... he probably had a wicked bout of salmonella at some point that had the trot, so.
Dude still looks yoked at, like, age 70, so.
Indeed, but I definitely would love to stumble onto his pharmaceutical bag, so.
For sure, for sure.
I might finally crack 190 pounds, you know, jacked and lean with Sly Stallone's travel pouch, so.
All right, moving on. Question from Fran. In Podcast 7, you talk about a hockey player who wanted to get strong but wiry, not add lean mass. You mentioned certain training protocols. So she has two questions. Many women want to get strong and athletic without adding mass, i.e. I don't want to bulk up. Could you talk about how to train females for wiry strength without adding mass? Maybe it's different than for a young man like the hockey player. Maybe there's more leeway since women don't add as much bulk in the first place.
Yeah, there's a ton of leeway here, and it sounded like the dude that the hockey player, I'm blanking on his name, but it sounded like he put on muscle really, really easily. So this is just not an issue. You know, occasionally I'll see a woman who says, I put on muscle real, real easily, and you look at her and you're like, yes, indeed you do. But this is like 1 in 100, and it's more often a non-compliant diet person who just still wants to do a bunch of cardio and eat a bunch of low-fat, like, snack wells and stuff like that. So that's a really, really rare issue that's legit.
This is the problem we both wish we had.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I have a friend from high school that won't deadlift because it makes his legs too big. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry you can't buy pants. I'm really, really breaks my heart.
Yeah, I have no sympathy for that individual at all.
All right, question two. What is the 10x1 or 8x2 training protocol you mentioned in the context of the hockey player?
Oh, boy. Practical programming or something like that would be a good place to look for this stuff. The 10x1, 8x2, it's just a strength-oriented, comparatively high intensity, you know, relatively high one rep max percentage for a particular lift. Done usually with a reasonable rest periods, anywhere from 1 to 3 minutes. And not a load of volume, and so the theory is that you will neurologically get very, very strong, but not put on a lot of mass. And, you know, some of the science and practice of strength training by Zach Siorski and some other folks, the pre-Leppin charts are some good places to look for some info on that, too. This is some fundamental stuff that should be covered in, like, any type of strength and conditioning certification, but oftentimes gets skipped in various localities, but...
Yeah, I think we were talking about in context of the hockey player who is clearly a beast, and, you know, this is often used for folks that are like weight class athletes that can't afford to really add any more lean mass, but we do want to try to improve absolute strength.
Yeah, totally, and of course, Pavel is a great resource for all that wiry strength type stuff, so, you know, take a look at his what he has to go on, power to people and all that type of stuff.
Yep, good. Good question.
Yeah.
All right, Rob. The final question of the day.
Woo-hoo!
We're going to make it.
Four of the seven listeners have already fallen asleep, so we'll have to hurry this one up. The other three have a GI irritation from all the fish oil we've recommended. So,
telling you, we need some new jokes. We're dying here. I'm dying. Your poor wife is like, why are you still talking about this?
You just see me every day, and so it gets reused that way. These folks only listen to us once a week.
That's true. They probably still think you're funny.
Yeah, I keep that veneer going.
All right. Last question from Jeff. He is a 41-year-old weighing about 150 pounds. He just completed a round of P90X and dropped about 15 pounds in 3 months. After that round, I did some research and have been going paleo primal based on Mark Sisson's book, Primal Blueprint. I've maintained my weight and am now doing a hybrid of home-based training using P90X+, kettlebells, and a suspension system. I'm right around 10% body fat. How low should my body fat get before I consider adding mass? I've heard it said you should follow this protocol before adding mass.
Oh, man. I think right around that 10% body fat level and just making sure you don't have a lot in the way of love handles going on. And then you can start upping the caloric content, really emphasizing post-workout nutrition, figure out if you're going to tackle that in a post-workout, like a cyclic low-carb fashion, post-workout, you know, protein-carb deal. If you're insulin sensitive, then you could do the protein-carb thing. You could add a gallon or a half gallon of milk post-workout. It's a couple of different ways of tackling that. But if he really wants to add mass, It sounds like what he's doing is really good, but I would definitely stick at least a couple of legit heavy linear overload barbell movements in there. A back squat, a deadlift, a press, maybe a weighted pull-up in addition to the stuff he's doing. Otherwise, you're just really not going to get that much in the way of a growth stimulus out of what he's up to.
Yeah, I think this is the one where it would seem like he could potentially get a fair amount of work capacity out of what he's doing, but probably not a lot of absolute strength.
Right.
And, you know, no judgment on the P90X other than the infomercials. I've never watched the videos, but my gut tells me that that's one of the big missing links in the chain there.
Yeah, just some heavy strength training, but I mean, the P90X stuff is legit in that it mixes a lot of different stuff together. They've made it a slick, kind of sexy advertising deal, and people dig it. And you know, it's pretty interesting. People seem to do it over the long haul. People even drag their DVDs into gyms to do it. It's kind of wacky to me.
Well, it is based on muscle confusion, Rob. So,
dude, I am fully confused. Then I'm all about it. So, yeah.
And I'd be curious what suspension system Jeff has. Jungle Gym, TRX, maybe there's a new one I don't know about. But anyway, yeah. All legit. Pick up heavy things, like Mark Sisson says in the Primal Blueprint.
Yeah.
And with that, Rob, hour and 15 minutes. Not too bad, actually.
Not bad, yeah, with a fair amount of wandering.
So. Yeah, I feel pretty good for us totally being sleep-deprived and heavily caffeinated that we didn't offend too many listeners.
Well, we may go from 7 listeners down to 2 listeners by next week, so we'll see how badly we pissed everybody off. But yeah, I think we navigated this one pretty good considering our mental state. So.
Awesome. Well, with that is the end of episode 12. Thanks, Rob, and I'll talk to you next week.
Awesome, Andy. Thanks.
All right, see you, man.
Bye.